Okay, we're starting in Judges, the 16th chapter tonight. We have just a little bit left to do to finish the lesson on Samson. It's lesson 15, page 34. Then we'll get to the next lesson that we've chosen in this series, the story of David and Goliath. That will follow just promptly after we finish the discussion on Samson. So Judges chapter 16 in your Bibles and page 34 in your notebooks. We're at the end of his life, and we're talking about how it has ended up, not as he as God would have planned it, or his parents either. The Philistines have already captured him by this time, had his hair shaved, gouged his eyes out, fastened him in fetters with chains. And the feast is now ongoing in the house of Dagon. They're giving thanks to their God for the capture of their enemy. You'll see there in verses 23 and 24 is their praise to Dagon. Samson's brought in to be the clown, if you will, to make sport. They're going to make sport of him or have him for entertainment purposes. And he's between the pillars. And he's blinded, of course, by this time. So the house being full of the lords and the Philistine officials, at least 3,000 are on the roof. Samson pushed the supporting pillars out. The entire building collapsed. What was the statement that he said right before his death? Well, that's before that. He said, he prayed to God, give me strength that I may be avenged for my two eyes. And he cried out saying, let me die with the Philistines. That was his last statement. Some have looked at that rather suicidally. If you want to look at it that way, I guess you can. I don't know that I could argue with you. But he purposes that. That's what his focus is at this time, is to kill them with his own death. So it's an act of personal vengeance. He wants to be avenged or paid back for the loss of his eyes. Samson did kill more in his death than he had cumulatively in his entire life. The Bible does say that. That is in the end of verse 30. So he's had a lifetime, at least since he's been a judge and been active in with God using him in destroying the Philistines. He's killed a lot of them, but he in one final swoop, he killed at least 3,000 at his death. So this is indeed a sad ending, as we've been portraying. It didn't have to end like this. Samson's choices have gotten him to where he is at this moment. He was supposed to have lived a noble, godly life as a Nazarite. God still endowed him with great strength through his life, which he used. But what we've been talking about more so in this study, yes, his faith is commended in Hebrews 11. He's mentioned by name in that great faithful chapter. But however, we've been talking about the choices he made in terms of his conduct and his behavior that have not been wise. We would not certainly commend them to us or others today. God, through His power and omniscience, was able to use those choices nonetheless, but we need to understand that they led Him to places that were not helpful to Him and wound up hurting Him, even being very detrimental to His livelihood. Okay, anything else about the story of Samson? We've talked about a lot of things with this story. Think about him when you... We only think about it when we make choices, make decisions about what to do, where to go, how to behave, so forth, who we interact with, and Samson stands as an example to follow. Comments or questions, anybody? Okay. Yes, sir. Go ahead, Norm. Yes. All right, that's a good point. Delilah certainly stands as an extreme example of, I think Norm's point is good. And we do have associates, and some, and if I don't want to put words in, enormous mouth. He can certainly speak for himself. But if I understood the kind of thing he was talking about, not that we're forced into certain situations, but we do have to go to work, right? And we do have to live with people in our own family. So maybe we are more inclined to be with some other than it being a choice. But at the same time, if they're not New Testament Christians, then we are to seem different than they. We have to look different than they. We have to talk different than they talk. We have to dress different than they dress. And we need to seem different than them. And so I think your point is good. It may not be this extreme example. Delilah's lap may not be this exotic, sensual thing that was portrayed in this story. It could be just something that's not spiritual in terms of New Testament Christianity. But still, we must see it for what it is. Let's not ever get lulled into a sense of complacency that we fail to see things for what they really are. And that is, if it's not of Christ, it's of the world. And the Bible certainly does make that point over and over again. All right. Anybody else? Before we go to the next story. Okay, now turn to page 35, and this is lesson 16, and your Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 17. We again jump ahead quite a bit. The story of a giant killer. This is another familiar story, David and Goliath. Just by way of some introductory comments, usually it's the old who's supposed to lead the young. That's how it's supposed to work. The older among us, they've got the faith that's more mature. They've got wisdom and experience on their side, and they should be able to use that to guide those who are not as knowledgeable. It's not shameful to be less knowledgeable when you're young. You're just not supposed to know as much. You've not lived long enough. But sometimes it's reversed, isn't it? In some situations, we've seen, even in local churches, we've seen sometimes it's the younger who are going to lead the older. And it's not so much because the younger are that talented, but really, why do we see that sometimes? Because the older won't do what? They won't step up and lead. And somebody's got to lead. Somebody's got to be out in the front doing whatever needs to be done. And so here we have an occasion. You get to the sort of the middle of this story, and David gets on the battle scene, and who has answered Goliath's challenge to fight? Nobody. Nobody's saying a thing. Here comes David. And certainly said, well, I'll go fight him. Now we know how he was disdained for that, and he was like this, you little boy. You don't have any idea what you're saying, and we'll talk about all that. But here's an example of that very thing. And sometimes it's the younger who will show the older how to go about it and how to be faithful, how to trust in God and have confidence in Him and lead in ways of righteousness. So if the older won't serve, then someone's going to have to. And often the younger show greater faith in situations than do their older counterparts. And I wish that wasn't so, but sometimes that is. So that's kind of a double-edged sword. That's commendable for the young to be that mature. It's also a sad commentary on those who need to be leading and won't. It's not that they can't, it's that they won't. They won't step up and do things that they should be able to by this time. So that's what we're going to be looking at in terms of this story. That's an example of what we're talking about here. One of the more familiar stories in all the Bible. I think even if you take a remotely worldly person who is just somewhat remotely connected with the Bible or knows about it. They've heard the name Goliath before. They know who Goliath is. They may not believe it, but they at least heard it. So they've heard the name, this big giant. And David's a slingshot that brought down the great giant. So David's defeat of Goliath, the Philistine giant, and his victory is a faith builder for us. Again, that's why we're going through these Old Testament stories, to build faith, draw us closer to God, and make us more appreciative of Him, what He's done for us, because still we have Goliaths to fight today. Now, of course, not literal ones, but figurative ones. And we're going to defeat our Goliath the same way David defeated his. That's faith in God and belief that He will deliver. Okay. At the opening verses of chapter 17, again, who is the opponent? Well, it's Philistia again. And Israel is oppressed, if you want to use that word, or being opposed by the Philistines. In the chapters 4 through 7 of this book, 1 Samuel, Philistia was actively opposing Israel in the days of Samuel the prophet. And then, of course, Samuel was God's instrument through whom was chosen the first king, which was who? Saul. And chapters 13 and 14, as well as this chapter, Saul, of course, is king. But even early on, again, Saul is having to battle the Philistines. So, arguably, the greatest or most recurrent opponent of Israel in the Old Testament was Philistia, always fighting the Philistines. And this chapter is no different. You get to the start of chapter 17. The Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and so Israel did the same there in verse 2. Saul and his armies camped. They drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. So you here have this situation in verse 3. The Philistines on one mountain, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, and the valleys between them. So they're just kind of at a face-off now, ready to go to war, if you will. And they do line up in battle array to fight against the Israelites. Now, their main weapon, they had a champion. He's mentioned to us in verse 4. It says, "Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath." Now we have some verses or some points here that describe him. What's the first descriptive statement about Samson? Excuse me, Goliath. I need to leave that other one behind. Let's stick with this one. What's the first thing we hear about him? All right. The Bible says he stood 6 cubits and a span. Now there's some differing interpretations of what a cubit was, but we'll just go with the more traditional cubit. How long was a cubit, typically speaking? It's 1.5 feet. So 6 cubits is, that'd be 9 feet tall. And how long was the span? It said it was about 0.5 cubits is what I've read. So about 9 inches. Okay? So Goliath stood 9 feet, 9 inches tall. When we see this term champion, I take that to mean he was a battle-tested hero. He was seasoned. He was a fighting man. All right? Now, if we brought him in here tonight, how tall do you think he would stand among us? Let's put him in this room. Well, Roger's our standard. His shoulder's taller than Roger. Yes. 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 All right. Okay. But let's make it even easier than that. James is right. These paneling boards are 8 foot tall. He's at least taller than that. Let's stick to the back of the building here. All right. You see this molding back here that's even with the side light fixture. So that's about 8 foot tall at the back. And of course, the floor slants this way. So we're going to stay back here in the back where it's kind of level. Brought my tape measure and I measured it. The top of Samson's head is right in the middle of that clock face. Now that's how tall he would be. No, that's not 11 foot. I mean, 9 foot's tall enough. We don't need to give him any more height. 9 feet, 9 inches. But that middle of that clock face is 21 inches above that piece of mold. So if you were to go back here and stand under that clock face and look up, that's how big a man he was. He was humongous. Now, I wonder how muscular he was. You think he was some little beanpole? I doubt it. I know he wasn't a beanpole because what else do we have about him information-wise from the Scripture after we learned of his height? Yeah, I mean, a beanpole couldn't carry armor that weighs what we're told here. His armor weighed about 128 pounds. That's just his armor. Now, thin guy can't carry that. All right? And that weight is approximate. I mean, again, I think you can consult different sources and you might get a little different amounts, but we'll stick with that, basically. All right? What about the shaft of his spear? What's the Bible say? It's like a weaver's beam. And the head, or the point, of the spear, made of iron, weighed how much did it say? 600 shekels. What's that? Well, that's about 15 pounds. Just for the spear point. 15 pounds. So, here's this man. He just had to have been... Well, imagine how intimidating that was. To see this man fully armored, got this great big spear, he's walking around with this much weight on him, just his armor, plus who does he have going in front of him? He's got his own shield bearer, his own armor bearer. Okay? So here he is. Now, who do you think he was afraid of? He wasn't afraid of anybody. He didn't need to be afraid of anybody. And when you start reading about what he does in this chapter, starting especially in verse 8, and his words through verse 10, and then the one statement in verse 16, does it surprise you that he would employ those tactics? Anybody that big, and obviously that strong, is going to try to intimidate anybody and just be a bully. And just dare anybody to come out here and whip him. Now that's just who he was. And all the men on the side of the Philistines, they were glad to have him on their side, I'm sure. That's our man. Well, we'll stand behind you, Goliath, all the way. You lead us into battle and we're with you. Well, that's how big a man he was. Okay? That's what we're faced up against here if you're in the army of Israel. So his tactics now. He used intimidation. We're calling it bully tactics. Starting in verse 8. Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? That is to say, why do we have all these armies out here? He's saying, in essence, and I'm not commending what he's saying or his methods, but his point is simple. Why involve all the armies? Let's just pick a man. All right, I'm going to be for our side, and you all pick your best man over there. And let's just have it out one against one. Right? And what's at stake? What's the stakes here? All right. The winner, his nation gets to rule over the loser. The loser's nation. But we won't have all this bloodshed in the battle. Okay? Let's just make it man on man. One against one. And we'll just keep it simple that way. That's verses 8. He says there in verse 9. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, which he knew wasn't going to happen, he's convinced of that. That's why he's so bold in this. Then, you know what? If he can do that, then we'll serve you. But if I kill him, then you got to serve us. And verse 10, his statement again is very intimidating. He says, my version says, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. I defy you. I dare you. This is a stare down. Come out here and fight me if you can. How long did this go on? Look at verse 16. He came out and did this every day. 40 days. It's time for Samson's challenge. Came out here every morning, just like clockwork probably. Here comes Samson again up to offer his challenge. Come on, somebody, come out here and fight me. Day after day after day. Now, you're on Israel's side, all right? And you keep hearing this. How does the Bible describe Israel's reaction to all this? Now, they're seeing him. I mean, we can only picture him in our mind's eye, what he looked like. But they're right there in front of him. They can see him. They can hear him. What do they think about all this? They're scared to death, Bill says. That's right. Greatly dismayed or greatly afraid. Who volunteered for the challenge? Nobody. Nobody's going to take that. I think I'll pass. Not up to that challenge. Even whoever would have been Israel's best fighting man wasn't going to do it. When Saul was inaugurated king or made king, remember how the Bible described him? He stood head above everyone else. So apparently maybe even Saul's the tallest man, and he's not that big. I mean, that's not going to work. So maybe not even their biggest man is going to take this challenge. And if he won't do it, then who else will? This is a defining moment. So he demanded an Israelite to fight. The nation of the winner would rule over the nation of the loser. He issued this challenge for 40 days. verses 8 through 10, as well as verse 16. And he was successful. Let's give Goliath his credit. The Bible says that Israel was dismayed and greatly afraid because of him. They're not going to move off of their fear. So no Israelite accepted challenge. So that's where we are with this. All right, now, look at question 3. This gets us to now verse 17. Here comes David on the scene. What is the first thing David is told to do? And by the way, who's giving David his orders right now in verse 17? All right, it's his father, Jesse. How many sons did Jesse have? He has 8. He's got 8 sons. The 3 oldest, where are they? They're with Saul up in the stair down with Goliath. And so Jesse tells David, now in the birth order, where's David? He's the baby. He's young at home, younger than his brothers. He's taking care of the family flocks, the sheep. And so Jesse tells David, do what? He's got 2 things for him to do. All right, bring him some supplies. In fact, he mentions what the supplies are. Let's look in verse 17. Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain, 10 loaves, bread, if you will, and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese, verse 18. So take them some food. Take them some supplies, if you will. They need these. That was one half of it. What was the other thing Jesse wanted? Yeah, and you come back and tell me how they're doing. I want a report, if you will. Tell me what their welfare is. Tell me how they're faring in all this battle business. If I was concerned about his sons, obviously, so I want to know what's going on here. So that's David's mission. So he gets up to the battle scene. We get now to verse 20. David arose early in the morning, left the flock with the keeper, took the supplies, and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the circle of the camp where the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Well, they can do that good. They just can't go fight Goliath, can they? But they're all into this war cry business. All right. There you see again in verse 21, they draw up in battle array, army against army. David left the baggage in the care of the baggage keeper. That is the things he took up there. And he ran to the battle and entered in order to greet his brothers. He's just right there in the thick of it. Isn't that just like little brothers? Just getting right in the middle of it. Has to know what's going on. And he starts talking. Little brothers start asking questions, talking this, talking here and there. And he was talking with them as he was doing that. Here comes Goliath. Out with his daily taunt, his daily intimidation, if you will. Look at the end of verse 23. David heard it for himself now. He doesn't have to rely on testimony. Well, you know, we've heard Goliath say, now David hears it for his own ears. He's witness to it. So he arrives there, he sees the situation. He heard Goliath's challenge. And David starts asking some questions, doesn't he? Just like brothers do. Verse 25. This was not so much a question of David, but this is talk amongst the soldiers. What do we learn in verse 25? What's the Bible teach us? Yeah, Saul kind of has to, motivate. He wants to offer a motivation for someone to accept Goliath's challenge. Since no one was going to do it freely, just out of pride and honor, all right. Well, maybe I don't want to use the word bribe, but maybe it's the motivation. What motivation did Saul offer for whoever would accept Goliath's challenge? His daughter? You get the king's daughter for a wife. Riches? What about the man's family or his house? Yeah, when it says that I'll make his father's house free in Israel, think that would mean tax-free. You would not have to pay whatever taxes that would normally be imposed by the king. So if his daughter was pretty, I mean, that might be enough incentive for some. If she's ugly, I don't think it'd be very much incentive, but we're assuming she's beautiful, pretty. And then this money, monetary incentive. So that's what the talk was. And so then as David gets in there and he hears all this chattering going on and he starts asking questions, what question does David ask? Yeah, what does the man get that accepts the challenge? That's his question there in verse 26. What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Now, before we look at the response to David's question, David says something else. Now, to us reading this story, what do you think about David? What do you think about David's statement at the end of verse 26? Is it 26 or 27? 26, yeah. What do you think about that, David's words? Absolutely. Does anybody have a problem with what David said? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? Who does he think he is? Now, from where we sit today, we would certainly commend David, his faith in the Lord, obviously. But how did his brothers take it? He's a nut. Roger said he thought he was a nut. In fact, who was the oldest of Jesse's sons? He's there. Eliab is there. And did he have anything to say to his little brother? God, what did he say, basically? That's right. You're just in the way. Who do you think you are? In fact, he accused him of two things. He accused David of two things. So he sees David as just this loudmouthed little kid who's just in the way, doesn't have any business being there, and just talking about things he didn't know anything about. So David inquired about this reward from Saul, and Eliab rebukes him. Verse 28. The two rebukes he says. The Bible says Eliab's anger burned against David. He's pretty hot at him. Why have you come down? Now, his first question. What's he accuse him of? Yeah, you've got work to do, and since you're here, I know you're not doing it, so you're neglecting your duties. He accuses him, or at least intimates, that David is neglectful in what he should be doing. He shouldn't be there. This is for men, so to speak. You've got no business being here. But he also, and this isn't just a suggestion, this is not an outright word that he uses. He says, I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart. The word insolence means haughtiness or pride, stubborn pride. David, you don't know what you're saying. You don't have any idea what's going on here. And if you'd be walking around here talking to all these men and asking all these questions, that you're out of your league, buddy. You need to get back to where you belong, and that's watching the sheep. So what did at least his older brother, and most likely I think we could assume that the other soldiers would have thought the same of David. We'll call him a boy. I mean, he's probably a young man for all we know, but he's a lot younger than the other ones. But the prevailing thought amongst probably most of the soldiers versus David, what do they think about him being there, more or less? You're just in the way. We don't appreciate this. You need to get out of here. All right. So here we have two different perspectives from where you and I sit today. I like what Angela said a few moments ago, the end of verse 26. David certainly was thinking about this from God's view. He had God's interest at heart, didn't appreciate the armies of the living God being taunted. You taunt the armies of God, you're taunting God as far as David was concerned. They're the same. But the brothers, they didn't think much of David being there. Didn't like it at all. So he is rebuked by his brother. And David, again, here's Here's David's response. Verse 29. What's David say? Well, what did I do? I just asked a question. What are you biting my head off for? I didn't do anything. I'm just wanting to find out what's going on over here. And verse 30. So David turns away from Eliab, that his brother, and he turns to another and said the same thing. And basically, how did people answer him? The same. Just like Eliab did. David's not going to find any friends here. Nobody there, it appears, that not many there think he needs to be there. Right. Now, he's there because his father sent him. And all this reaction, if you will, from the soldiers, that's how they view David. So that's the situation. All right? Goliath's taunting. Saul's offered a reward. Nobody's accepting. David's been sent there by his father and his older brother Eliab, and most likely others are not appreciative of David, sort of that. The way it seems to me that they accuse him of just kind of being in the way. And it's not a good situation. All right, any comments down through verse 30? Questions, anybody? Okay, well, look now at the bulk of the chapter, 31 through the first half of verse 51. David's going to get involved now. Jesse did not send him to go fight. But David's there now, and David's heard enough. So, the news comes to Saul. Verse 31. The king is told, the way the Bible reads, the words which David spoke were heard. When they were heard, they told them to Saul. Now, whatever kind of spin they put on it, we don't know. But they may have said, there's this young man out here kind of roaming around, and he's just, you know, talking amongst all the soldiers. Or maybe they told Saul David's words from the end of verse 26. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Maybe they didn't even tell Saul it was a young man. Maybe they said, there's a guy here saying, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? They didn't tell the king the man's age. What do you think Saul might have thought when he heard that? I've got a volunteer. I've got somebody who will finally fight this guy. Because it's been how long? 40 days. And nobody ever took the challenge. So, for however it was worked out, the king sends for the man who's been all this talking, and it's David. Right, David comes. And we see there in verse 32, David speaks up. David says, let not the heart of my king, or let no man's heart fail on account of him, that is Goliath. Don't faint about this. Don't be afraid of this. David boldly says what? I'll fight him. Now he's a youth, okay? We know he's a youth because what does Saul say? He describes him. He says, well, in fact, first thing Saul says is what? David says, I'll fight him. Saul says what? You can't fight him. Who are you kidding? You can't fight him. You are but a youth. Now, whatever a biblical youth was, I don't know what that age was, but that's what Saul said to him. You're just a youth. How's he describe Goliath? He's been a warrior from his youth. Now, David, he'll make mincemeat out of you. It won't even be a fair fight. Probably could crush you with one hand and not even break a sweat doing it. So David reassures him, but Saul dismissed David's offer just out of hand. He didn't say, well, let me think about it. No, he said, you cannot do this. You're only a youth. He's been a warrior from his youth. And I want you to contrast David's faith. This is not insolence talking. It doesn't matter if that's what Eliab said. This is not insolence. This is not pride. I take this to be what it is, and that's faith. David had faith. And contrast that to Saul's unbelief. We recently went through the story of the 12 spies, Numbers 13 and 14. And remember, we made a lot of comment on the contrasting statements. The two spies, Joshua and Caleb, said about taking the land, we can take it. We can do it. The 10 spies said what? We can't do this. There's just no way we can do this. Same point here. David says, listen, I'll fight it. I can do this. Saul says what? David, you can't do this. No faith. And we may have here the beginning of not the beginning. We've already had some indication from Saul, at least in chapter 13 of this book, as also as in chapter 15. What kind of man, this isn't a lesson on Saul so much, but what kind of man had Saul proven to be already? What kind of man was he? What kind of character did he have? Yeah, he was concerned only for himself. Was he described as a faithful person, you think? He was not faithful. Not at all. He tried to assume the priestly duties. Remember when Samuel was late in coming, chapter 13? He's got to go fight the Philistines. And Samuel wasn't there to offer the sacrifice. So what did Saul do? He's going to do it himself. And God wasn't happy with that. In chapter 15, God said, destroy all the Amalekites. Get rid of all of them. Don't spare anybody. What did Saul do? He spared the king. Spared the best of the animals. Made those for sacrifices. So Saul has not been, typically speaking, a faithful Hebrew. One that walked by faith. So here comes David, full of faith. This is not youthful pride. This is faith talking. All right? And Saul just says, no, David, you're wrong. You cannot do this. So contrast David's faith with Saul's unbelief. So now David's going to respond. This is kind of an exchange, right? David says something, Saul says something, David says something in reply. Now let's look at David's response. This puts us at this is the bottom of page 35, the last part of question 4, verses 34 through 36. David's response. David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. Let's read verse 37 also. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. Now we learned some things here about David, all right? One thing that strikes me in this is that when David mentions his prior duties as a shepherd, you know, we get the idea that a shepherd just sits somewhere like up on a cliff and with his little stick and he just kind of watches the sheep. And that's just kind of how that is. But apparently what David says, what was involved in being a shepherd? More than just watching sheep. You got to protect them, that's right. And if need be, here comes a predator. Well, who is the sheep dependent on? What are the defensive mechanisms of a sheep? He doesn't have any. He's totally in the hands of the shepherd. Needs the shepherd for defense. Now, David didn't say, here come this bear, here come this lion, and I just kind of chased them away and they ran off and that was the end of that. That's not what he says. Apparently, what had happened? They got close enough, put one in his mouth. Was walking away, that was going to be their meal. And what did David do? He went after the sheep, and he says, the bear or the lion, and I rescued the animal from its mouth. So this is close hand-to-hand combat. Okay? And apparently the animal, the predator, didn't think much of David's interference because he says, when he rose up to kill me, what David said he do? I grabbed him by the beard. Now here's a snarling lion. Okay? And David grabs the beard of this beast. Takes his stick and David just beats the tar out of him. Just kills him. So tell me how much courage David has. He's got courage. Does David take his duties seriously? He most certainly did. Most certainly did. Now, what did David ever know about who was really responsible for his success as a shepherd? Does he say so in his words to Saul? He does, doesn't he, Kathy? He says, verse 37, "The Lord delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear." Now, the Lord didn't come down here and beat the lion up. David did that. But as far as David was concerned, who's responsible? It was God. God was watching over me, God protecting me. And if God took care of me then, what's David think now? He's going to do it again. Now, that's faith. See. That's what we're talking about. Faith building. Our time is gone. We have to stop for tonight. So we'll pick up this discussion on Sunday morning, the Lord willing. May even get to where we finish this lesson and then go ahead and do the last lesson, lesson 17. Thank you for your good comments tonight.